We're on the top of page 10. I'm going to go through and some explanations. What we're doing is we're looking at our communication with God. We've been looking at the word prosukamai, which is translated almost uniformly in our English Bibles by the word pray or prayer in the New Testament, because it's a Greek word, obviously. We're not talking about a Hebrew word. And what we have demonstrated so far in looking at the past few pages of our material is we've been demonstrating that the word prosukamai is not a general term for communication. Most people, when they say pray, pray to them simply means talking to God in terms of asking Him for things, thanking Him, worshiping in Him. It's all these different things combined. And what we're trying to demonstrate is that this word, prosukamai, refers to worship. It is the New Testament worship word. If this word doesn't mean worship, then the one thing that's interestingly absent from our New Testament letters is the idea of worship. Because we already looked at the fact that worship in those letters is never used with regard to believers, with the exception of perhaps one passage in 1 Corinthians 14. But we are demonstrating that in reality, this word represents the worship for the believer. And we've showed it from a number of different angles. Now what we're going to be doing, having proved this from a number of places, we're going to be going through and we're going to look at a number of passages and we're going to show it, connect it in different ways to help you understand what's going on. Because the way it's represented in our English Bibles, we think somebody's praying for somebody. And you'll see this in just a minute. Let's just take as a first example. Turn to Acts 12, which we have down below there, but turn to Acts 12. Let me switch here to Acts 12. Acts chapter 12 and verse 5. Now, this isn't the context, if you remember, that Herod has thrown Peter into prison. Peter's locked up in the inner prison, and while he's in prison, it says verse 5, and therefore Peter was being kept in the prison, but prayer was earnestly being made by the church facing God concerning him. That's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to look up here at what we have. Let me make this one bigger. It might be a little bit more helpful. It says, on the one hand, therefore, Peter being kept in the prison, prayer now was earnestly coming to be made by the church. They're the ones that are doing it. So by the church, by the ecclesia, facing the God, that's who they're talking to. And then this is what we're going to focus on tonight. This word right here, peri. It's a preposition, and your English Bibles are going to translate it, as mine does right here, prayers were being made for him. It's there. It says right here, prayer for him. We have over in the new, this is the New American Standard on this side. My English text here has for him too, but it's this preposition, peri, and it's used here in this case, with this is a genitive pronoun, he, for him, okay? So it's a genitive pronoun. Those two letters on the end tell you that this is genitive. Now let me explain Greek cases for just a second. Every noun has a case in Greek. The case is determined by the ending of the word. So every word in here, this is an accusative ending. Those two letters tell you this is an accusative. This is a genitive ending. Let's see if I can see another one in here real quick. Oh yeah, this ending here, this is a lid case ending, petros, the os ending in this case with that, that's a nominative ending. Every Greek word, every Greek noun, I should say, has an ending that tells you how it's used in the sentence. The nominative is the subject of the sentence. The genitive and ablative forms, that's what we're looking at right here, that's the case of description or the case of relationship or case of separation that are involved in this. This case that we have pictured right here, with the word in the prison, those endings, That's the lib case. Lib case is your locative. In that case, that's where he's at, locative in the prison. The instrumental, which would be how or by means of. And then the dative, where you do something to or for an individual. Okay? And then the accusative case, which is God here. See, the prayers are being made earnestly facing what? Facing accusative limits, facing the God. Accusative is equivalent to our English of an object. So if I throw the ball, that's the object of the sentence. Okay, I am the subject. I throw the ball to Edward. Edward would be, this case, if you were writing in Greek, it would be indirect object, dative. Okay, that's so every Greek noun has that. What we're and then there are all these words called prepositions. And this is a good sentence because we have in the prison, by the church, facing the God, concerning, we're going to talk about this in a little bit. So we have three prepositions, en, hupo, pros, and peri. Okay? Prepositions are used with cases. They help further indicate the relationship of words to one another. When prepositions are used with different cases, sometimes their meanings are different. Now, if you look on the sheet, in the fine print towards the top, the preposition peri is used with two cases. It's used with the genitive and with the accusative case. With the genitive, it means about. In fact, if you look at that, if you look at the English spelling of the word peri in the first line there, you can see how we get the word perimeter or perimeter, the measure around, okay, a thing. So the perimeter of your yard. You put up a fence on the perimeter of your yard, it's a fence that goes around the edge of your yard. And so this is about, we have in here, about in a general sense. And the accusative is used about in a localized or specific sense. We're going to look at a couple of illustrations of this. So, turn your Bibles to John 7, John chapter 7. John chapter 7. John chapter 7 and verse 13. And just go back up to verse 10 and it says, "But after his brothers had gone up then to the feast, he also went, but he didn't go publicly, but as it were in secret. And the Jews were looking for him at the feast and they were saying, 'Where is he?' And there was a considerable complaining about him among the crowds, while some were saying, 'He's a good man.' Others were saying, 'No, he has deceived the crowd.' Yet," this is important, "yet no one spoke openly concerning him for fear of the Jews." And we have up here, no one spoke with boldness, literally, generally about him on account of fear of the Jews. In other words, all their statements are general. They're not talking about anything specific about him. They're not speaking loudly of things generally because they don't want people. In other words, they've got small, quiet, private conversations about him, but they're not getting large group conversations, and they're all general conversations. Okay? They're all general conversations, and that's the point about this. And again, you can see in this case, it's peri with this same preposition we saw earlier with that genitive case. Turn, however, to, or as another illustration, Acts chapter 10. Acts chapter 10. In verse 19. I hope this part up here isn't boring you. I'm a detail person, so I like to see this stuff. Hopefully it's helpful to you. If it's not, just ignore that and just look at your Bible there. But Acts chapter 10, Peter has been on the roof of a house. Remember, he's in Joppa. He's staying with a man, and while he's up on the roof praying, while they're fixing supper, this large vessel or sheet is let down, and there are all these animals, and this voice tells him to rise to slay and to eat, and Peter says no, because nothing unclean has ever touched my lips. I don't eat anything unclean. And remember, this goes on until the vision, until it's taken up, and God has told Peter what God has made clean, you don't make unclean. Now, we put in then at verse 19, which says, And Peter then was reflecting. He's throwing these things with some real enthusiasm in his mind, is the idea of reflecting here. Generally concerning the vision. Now I want you to look up here again. I point this out for those of you that are interested. Oh, I didn't pull it up. I was going to do that just a second. Let me pull it up. Acts 10 and verse 19, right? Get down to verse 19. Yeah, generally concerning the vision. Now you don't see this because it looks different. You might recognize the letters with the, but this is a different declension of noun, so it has a different ending on it. But this is the word vision. When he's talking about that generally concerning the vision, the idea is Peter is not sitting up there thinking about the details. He's not going, now what animals were in that sheep? Oh yeah, I saw that kind of an animal in there. And what was the sheep? What was the sheep made of, or the vessel? What was it? Was it made of fabric? Was it a canvas fabric? Was it some sort of a fine linen? Was it made of wood? You know, he's not thinking about those. Now, those are specifics. He's thinking generally about it because in his mind he's trying to think, what was this about? What was this thing about that I just saw? So rather than thinking about the intense specifics of all the details, what was the tenor of God's voice when he spoke with me? You know, he's thinking about what did it mean? Everybody got that? So this is talking again, it's still general. It's peri with the genitive. It's still in a general sense. Now turn to Mark chapter 3. We're not even looking at worship specifically yet, other than just to introduce it in Acts 12. Mark chapter 3. And we're going to look at peri with the accusative. Look at a couple of instances of this so you can see the contrast. Mark chapter 3. This is a time when he's been healing people. He's in the midst of a house with a number of people. And it tells us in verse 31, and his mother and his brothers, they were standing outside, and they sent to him, calling to him. And those that were sitting, interestingly enough, around him, there in verse 32, I actually should even pull that up because that is, let me do that, just pull that back up here a second. There's the peri, but not with the accusative. It's with the not with the genitive. It's with the accusative case here. They're sitting around him, and now this isn't generally. These aren't people loosely associated with him. It's not like people go, "Oh, there's a crowd. Let's go see what it's about." These are people that are specifically there to be by him. That's specifically why they're there, which is why you have peri with the accusative case, because it's indicating a closer specificity. Okay, less loose connection. And it says, so those that were sitting around him, they were saying to him, behold, your mother and your brothers and your sisters are outside and they seek you. And Jesus answering, he says to them, who is my mother and my brothers? And looking around about, again we have now, and here we have it in verse 34, at those who are around him, the same expression down here, peri around him, those that have close, specific contact with him in this way, they're gathered there to be with him. His mother and his brothers, we find out in other passages, are there not because they have a specific interest in listening to him. If anything, they have an interest in silencing him and taking him away and putting him away because they think he's nuts. But they don't have an interest in him like these people do. And so these are two real good examples in verse 32 and 34 of peri with the accusative. These people are specifically there to be with Christ. That's the object. That is the exact focus of why they're there. And that's why he uses it in this way. Let's see, what other ones? Oh, we have a similar... Oh, here's it. Yeah, Acts 13. I'm going to pull this one up on the computer. We'll just look at this quickly. Acts chapter 13. We've got a group of people that are... Paul is getting ready to set sail. Acts chapter 13. And it says, and having put out to sea from Paphos, those that were... In my Bible says, in the English, it's Acts 13. Okay, 13:13. I'll just read my English. It says, then Paul and his companions set sail from Paphos. Do most of you say something like Paul and his companions or something like that? Literally, the expression Paul and his companions is having set sail from there, from Paphos, the ones with Paul, and Paul indicating, but it's accusative here, a genitive with the, or a peri with the accusative, meaning specifically Paul's companions, they came to Perga. In other words, probably when the ship left Paphos, Paul and his companions were not the only people that paid for passage to get where they were going. So Paul probably had other travelers that were on the same voyage. But, and they were with Paul in a general sense because they were all in the same boat. But they weren't Paul's companions. And so by using peri with the accusative here, Luke is singling out those that were specifically there to be with Paul. They're his traveling companions. Okay. Last one that I want to look at is 1 Timothy chapter 1. And then we'll look at some passages where this peri is used with this, our word for worship. 1 Timothy chapter 1. And we read then, verse 7, that these, he's talking about people that are vain talkers, empty talkers. They desire to be law teachers, not understanding, and the word understand literally is they can't wrap their mind around fully what is going on, either the things which they say, neither generally concerning the things which they affirm. And this is peri with the genitive now. And what it's, and this is important because this is true of a law teacher. A real law teacher that tries to teach law for Christians today like these people always has to teach the law generally. Because if they taught it to you specifically, they'd be telling you, and if you break it, this law, we're going to have to take you out and put you under a pile of rocks. Because that's the specific penalty for doing this. Or you're going to have to bring this sacrifice to a temple, so we're going to have to figure out how to deal with the temple, and bring it to a priest, which, well, we don't really have a priest like that. You see why they can't speak about it specifically? Because the specifics don't exist. So they have to speak about it in a general sense. Well, let's see. Read yours in the English for me. Nor the things which they affirm. It goes with the things that they affirm, and your Bible doesn't even represent it. They don't even translate it in your Bible. It's not even translated that I can hear. It might be, and I just am not hearing it, but I don't hear it translated. Now, towards the end of that same chapter, then, in verse 19, he's talking about, I believe, a pair of these law teachers. And he says in verse 18, and then this charge I commit to you, my child Timothy, or child Timothy, according to the prophecy that went previously over you, that you should act as a soldier in these things, the good soldiering of the good warfare, having faith and a good conscience, which certain ones, specifically concerning the faith, have shipwrecked. And he uses peri now with the accusative, and this is what happens. When you start generally teaching about the law, it has the specific effect of ruining the Christian life. It's not just a general malaise in the Christian life. It specifically damages the Christian life. And so there's a real nice connection here where peri with the one has to be genitive, and peri specifically towards the end shows you the real intense effect that this has. Now, peri is used with this word prosukamai. It's used with this kind of prayer. We already looked at the one in Acts chapter 12, but I want to go back to Acts 12 now for a minute. And I want to talk about what they're doing with Peter. And I think once we point these things out, this one probably will be pretty easy, and the other ones hopefully will be too. But Acts chapter 12 and verse 5. Peter, as we already said, is in prison. It says, therefore, Peter being kept in the prison. It says, but prayer was coming to be made, or was being made by the church to God, generally concerning him. Now, this word prayer, remember, is our word for worship. And so, our inclination, when we read this in English, is to come to this passage and say, they're spending all night asking God to get Peter out of jail. So first, it'd be like, we're going to have a prayer meeting tonight. So, Tim, You got 5 minutes praying for 5 minutes. God, get Peter out of jail. Help the jailers to die or the doors to break open or I don't know. Help him. Now, Peg, it's your turn to come up with things to ask for Peter getting out of jail. Now Sue and now Jan and so on and so forth. That's not what they're doing. What he is indicating in the passage is that they are worshiping around Peter, generally about Peter. In other words, thinking about Peter being in prison, they're worshiping God around that situation. So you're thinking, God, what are prison doors to you? You are a God that is all powerful. You're the maker of heaven and earth. Breaking down the prison doors, that's not even finger play for you. I don't know if that's specifically what they were saying, but that's the idea. They are worshiping generally around Peter. They're not just spending all night going, God, get Peter out of prison. God, get Peter out of prison. God, get Peter out of prison. God, get Peter. You see, that is not what they're doing. By the way, this is very important here, and this is going to illustrate as we look at the rest of these passages. This is showing us why this worship is so important. Because if you were to spend all night doing nothing but incessantly asking God to change something, fix this thing, what are you focusing on? You're focusing on the problem. And the whole purpose of worship is to focus primarily on God. Perhaps letting the problem become something around which you begin to focus on God rather than the problem itself. And this is what the church is doing. And it's a good illustration of why worship, why this word occurs more than all the other words in the New Testament, because this is the backbone to everything else they're going to do when they talk with God. Okay? Turn to Colossians chapter 4. You may have a question on this passage before we move on. Okay. Colossians chapter 4.
I don't have a question on that passage, but can you repeat again I understand genitive is more general and then the accusative is more...
It's specific. See, so they're not so...
What are the cases again? Okay, that's Greek, but what is that analogous to
in
English?
In English, the accusative would be analogous to our the object case, okay. The object of a sentence. And the genitive, we don't really have a genitive in Greek, or in English, excuse me. Genitive would probably be closest. When you learn baby Greek, the way a lot of people learn the genitive is it's a case of possession. So his toy, his ball, okay. But the genitive in Greek is much broader than possession. The number one thing they do is to say description, because when you say his ball, really his is describing the ball, isn't it? It's really what it's doing. But there's other ways that you can do it. There are places like in Galatians 5:24, right after the fruit of the Spirit, it says, "And those that are Christ's, they've crucified the flesh with its passions and lusts." That's a genitive. Christ is a genitive. And most people translate that in a possessive, meaning those that belong to Christ. They've crucified the flesh with its passions and lusts. Well, is that true? Has every believer that belongs to Christ crucified his flesh? No, a lot of believers still are struggling with it. They haven't crucified it. The point is, those that are characterized by, the number one use of the genitive is to describe or characterize. So those that are characterized by the Christ, that is, they're exhibiting Christ-like character, which that's oftentimes what we describe the fruit from the Spirit. What is it? It's Christ-like character. He just got done talking about it. The fruit from the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, good, faith, meekness, self-control. Against such there is no law. And those that are of the character of the Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and lusts. You see? And that's a genitive. So it's a case of description. That's probably the broadest way to describe them. So when he's talking there that prayer is generally going up around Peter, what he's saying is it's generally about him. But they're not specifically just focusing on Peter. They're really focusing on God. See, the worship is there. But it's going generally around him, yeah, because he keeps coming to mind. He's in prison. And he's the cause for them to think about worshiping God in this context. Now, Colossians chapter 4. Colossians chapter 4. Verse 2, he says, holding fast in the worship you be watching in it with thanksgiving, worshiping all of you together, generally concerning us. Now notice he's going to give a request here. In order that God might open for us a door to speak the mystery of the Christ, on account of which I am bound. Interestingly enough, at the end, when he says, I am bound, that means I'm in a chain. And Paul is not saying, I'm wearing a chain attached to this Roman soldier because of this. He's saying, I am chained to give this message. And so I'm asking you that as you are worshiping God generally around me, that there's also the request to God give me an open door to speak this. Now what this is illustrating is exactly what goes on. We just referred to this over in Acts. So in a lot of ways this is the same type of situation. In Acts, yeah, are they asking for God to get Peter out of prison? Sure. But is that the word for prayer there? No. The word prayer is talking about worship about that. See, so there are two things are going on. The one is easy to figure out, just as in this case. It's easy for us to figure out in verse 3. Paul wants them to ask for something, but that's not the focus of the word worship. The focus of the word worship is on God, and it's generally around Paul. But as they are thinking about Paul, and as they are thinking about Paul and Paul's need for an open door, they are to be people who are worshiping. That's the point that he's getting at in this passage. So there's two things that are going on. This shouldn't surprise us because we just got done looking at the page in front, the page before this, as well as two other pages before that, pages 7 and 8, looking at worship combined with asking, worship combined with supplication, worship combined with intercession. So we know that it's used with all these other words. And Paul does not, every time he wants them to supplicate, he doesn't have to say worship and supplicate for me. He doesn't have to say that. These people know this. So what he's indicating is, and there's one other element. Let me put it together here for just a second here so you can see this one other, wrong part. One other thing to look at here, we have our word for worship here. When he comes up here, worship is a noun, and it's actually, and this is in verse 2, the verse before us, this is a locative noun. Down here he says, being worshiping ones, literally, worshiping ones all together. I think he's talking about the character. You people need to be worshiping ones, and generally concerning us. Also, so you're worshiping and are also generally around us. Now, let's take this from the other side. First, we were thinking about Peter. Peter's in prison, okay? Over in Acts. Acts 12, Peter was in prison. They're thinking about Peter. It should cause them to start worshiping God around the Peter situation and thinking about God, you are this, and God, you, that's what they need to focus on. But you know, it also works the other way, and I believe this passage illustrates it the other direction. Sometimes you're worshiping God, and as you're thinking about God's power, you're thinking, you're God of all power, and you know what? I know somebody that needs that power right now. They need to see a little of that power in action. Peggy needs to see a little of that power in action. I worshipped and prayed for her this afternoon because she got to go play piano at the elementary concert. And she had a couple little frustrations that she was concerned about today. And so when she got ready to leave, I prayed for her that it would go well, that she'd have good. She came back and she said it went well. I attribute it to God. She attributes the fact that she threatened the kids. No, I told her I prayed. She said, thank you. But the point is that sometimes while you're worshiping God, it also makes you think of other individuals and people that are connected to that. You're thinking, wow, God, you are an incredibly good God. You are the acme of happiness. You are a God that is so content. You are not a hand-wringing God. You're not a pouting God. You're not a grumpy God up there. You are a really happy God. You know what? I can think of somebody right now that really needs a dose of your happiness and your goodness in their life. And you think about them. That's what happens. And I can just tell you by experience, I know it's exactly the way it happens for me. Because I can sit down to think about God, and in the process, somebody that I might not have thought about for quite a long time pops into my head. And I'm thinking, God, I don't know what the connection is here, but I think that believer needs maybe a touch or to see a little example of this aspect of your character right now. Or sometimes maybe he puts one of you on my mind. And I didn't sit down thinking about you. But as I'm worshiping on God, God makes me think, oh, you know, Jan might need to see a little bit of that today, I guess. Because she's on my mind right now as I'm thinking about you here. So there's a real good example. Let's look at, we're not going to go to 1 Thessalonians 5:25 because it really is a repeat, a reiteration of what we just saw in Colossians 4:3. So we're going to skip over that. But turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. Second Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 9, Paul says, I'm just going to read the English for a little bit, and these will suffer the punishment of eternal destruction, separated from the presence of the Lord, from the glory of his might, when he comes to be glorified by his saints, to be marveled at on that day among all those who have believed because of our testimony to you has been believed. To this end then, verse 11 now, or actually in view of this thing, which also then we worship always generally around you, in order that you might be counted worthy of the, or God might count you worthy of the calling, or count us, excuse me, count, yeah, in order, no, that God might count you worthy of the calling, and might fulfill every desire or good pleasure of his goodness, both in terms of works from faith and by power. So Paul's thinking of the Thessalonians, and Paul says, as I worship God always, whenever I'm worshiping God, it always makes me come back to thinking of the needs that you guys have here to be worthy in your life of what he's called you to, and for you to really fill all the good pleasure of God. In other words, God's got things that are his good pleasure, his good determination, and you can be filling those things up. We might say, God, put it this way, God has expectations for you. He saved you as a child. Every one of you here, when you've had children, you have expectations for your children. Even when they're little babies like Hannah, you already have expectations for what they're going to be. My youngest one's going to graduate here in a couple days. Now, when she was Hannah's age, I wasn't thinking about her graduating, but you, in a general sense, you're thinking about, you know, I want this child to be able to run someday. I want this child to read well someday. I want this child to grow up and be polite. And there are things that do that. And as those children grow and they meet those expectations that you have, there's a sense of well-being in here, isn't there? There's some good pleasure because of the expectations you've had that you see them being fulfilled. Well, this is what Paul is saying, that he says, when I'm worshiping God and thinking of his character, I'm thinking of you people doing this. Meeting these expectations, this good pleasure that God has for you, because he birthed you as his children. And so Paul is thinking, I want you to be filling that. What aspect of God's character would be involved, specifically, if you're thinking about people growing and maturing in that way?
Faithful and true.
Faithful and true. This is exactly what comes to mind. It's, you know, there's a lot of characteristics of God. And if I were to say, do I have one that I choose over any, or the one that I focus on more than any others? I don't know if I could for sure, but faithful probably comes pretty close. Faithful and true. Because I just know as an individual how much I feel that I fail God. And I am overwhelmed by the fact that God never fails me. And God never stands there and taps his toe with his arms crossed and he says, well, you failed me. So he says, you got to wait a day before you talk to me again. He never does that. And even when I fail, God even ends up using that to continue pushing me and moving in that direction. It's an amazing thing. So I would say there might be one. Some of you others might be thinking of something different, but yeah. And the reason I'm coming up with these things is because I'm trying to get you to think about the character of God when you're thinking about other believers. Because this is exactly what Paul's getting at. That's why he's using peri with the genitive. As you're thinking generally about other people, you worship around them. Use the other saints that you know, whether they're in your church or another place, use them as a place to start around them worshiping God.
Worship.
It could be, yeah. Worshiping in spirit is that you are using your spirit. Yeah, that's what you're doing.
You're saying we're in spirit in God, and so are they.
When you're worshiping in spirit and truth, you're using your spirit to focus on the character of God. That's what you're doing. So when he says worship in spirit and in truth, use your spirit, not your emotions and not your body to worship God. Use your spirit part of your mind to focus on the character of God. And what you need to say about him needs to be true. Because that's where one of the places where modern Christendom really runs adrift when it comes to worship. That they say a lot of things about God that aren't particularly true. And when we want worship God, we want that worship to be in truth. We want it to be accurate. That's what God wants. God doesn't want you saying things to him that aren't true. I remember being in a Bible study once. I don't know how long ago it was or where we were at, but I remember somebody in that Bible study saying, I don't even know where it came from, but just, I think God kind of has a feminine side. And I just remember kind of being, not even knowing how to react. I'm just kind of dumbfounded. Okay, I did. And that one sticks in my mind when I think of saying things about God that aren't true. I'm sure there were. I'm not questioning that this person, whoever said it, maybe that their motives were wrong. But it's just learning to think it right about God, and maybe God has a feminine side that I don't know that the Bible teaches. But I'd be hesitant to say it without a good chapter and verse to say, yeah, God's got some sort of a feminine side. God's not sexual. I mean, he's asexual. He's not. We describe him as a father, but he's not a man. Okay. God is not a physical being. The Son became man, but the Father isn't a man. A male. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, again, verse 1. It says, and for the remainder then, brothers, you worship, again, generally concerning us. And again, we have a request then that's attached with their worship in order that the word of the Lord might run freely and be glorified even as also by you. So we have a very similar statement to what we had before. The last one I want to look at tonight is in Hebrews 13 and verse 8. 13:18. This one is important because actually in the context here, we actually have some statements of worship about God. And so you're going to have a nice illustration of how some of this comes together. It says in verse 17, it says, and you obey those who are leading you and you submit to them, to those that are keeping watch on behalf of your souls, even as those that have to render an account in order that they might do this with joy and not with groaning, because that is not profitable for you. Verse 18, and worship generally concerning us. For we are persuaded that we have a good conscience in everything, desiring or having a having by desire, having a good conduct, or having our conduct well, our conduct's fitting to the situation is what he's getting at. And even more than I encourage you to do this in order that I might be restored to you even more quickly. In other words, he says, as you're worshiping, worship for us. Now, I believe in the middle of verse 18 when he says, we are persuaded we have a good good conscience and that we have fitting conduct. I believe he's talking about, if you know that this is Paul writing this, you know that Paul, I think, has fought a little bit probably of a guilty conscience because of how he failed to deal with the things right in Acts 21. And now we're looking at about 4 years later, after he spent 2 years in prison, and now Paul is gone to Rome. When he's writing Hebrews, he's very, very close to being released. And as he's looking at this, Paul he's changed. The end of the book of Acts, you see that Paul has changed. Paul finally has wrenched, or God has finally wrenched the Jerusalem out of the Jew. And Paul is realizing, but Paul is still writing this letter back to those Jewish Christians because he's trying to correct the mistake he should have taken care of when he was down there. He should have stood in front of those Jews when they said, "We've heard this about you among the Gentiles. We've heard that you're telling the Jews not to circumcise their children. But we know this isn't true about you, Paul. And just to prove it, we got some men that have vows on their head, so you put up the money so they can offer their sacrifices and shave their heads." Because that's what they did as part of this vow. And Paul should have stood there, and Paul should have said, "Brothers, we are no longer under law. We are now under grace. And it's time to leave the temple. It's time to leave these sacrifices and move on to better sacrifices. Better things. With a better high priest than you're going to get up at that temple. With better promises." Where did Paul wait to actually say all those betters? Better high priest, better promises, better covenant in the book of Hebrews. He finally tells him in this letter the things that he probably should have told him in Acts 21. So Paul now, having kind of corrected his conduct, says, "Now our conscience is good. I'm convinced of this." I think that's why he says, we're convinced our conscience is good now. Because I think he probably had a guilty conscience in Acts 21. And I believe that that's why he's saying it in this way. And his conduct is good. In other words, he is practicing what he preaches now. And so he wants them to worship around him so that he does the right thing, so that he might be restored to them, meaning that he'd be released. And verse 20 now, here's where we have the worship come in. "Now the God of peace," that's a statement of worship. God is a God of peace. "The God of peace, the one having brought up out from the dead the great shepherd of the sheep." How did God raise him up? According to the end of Hebrews, or the end of Ephesians 1. What did God use to raise up Christ? What did he use? What? Power, Paul says. That same power that he raised up is the same power that works in us. So he's making reference to this God of peace, the God of power that raised him up, verse 21, "that he might equip or thoroughly adjust you in every good thing, in order that you then should do his desirous will. And that he might accomplish then in us the things that are well-pleasing before him through Jesus Christ. To him then is glory." So he has the ability to accomplish those things, and glory is for him. He gets his reputation into the age. You know, you and I, we have a reputation that some days it shines, some days it doesn't. Sometimes our reputation isn't anything to write home about. Things change, it fluctuates. And sometimes people know our reputation and sometimes people don't. But God's reputation is unchanging. It's perfect. It goes out into the ages. His glory. So it's a perfect statement of worship. So, just quick review tonight. What we've looked at is that worship can be made around an individual. You're not worshiping an individual. You're worshiping God, but you're worshiping God around that individual, or vice versa. As you're thinking about that person, you start worshiping God around them. So either you're focusing on God, worshiping around an individual, and then that worship comes to sit on that person, or vice versa, you're thinking about the person and it causes you to worship God around him. It goes both directions, depending on circumstances. And it's always appropriate, and what these begin to illustrate for us, is that worship is always appropriate. Worship always ought to be a part of your communication. Not out of an obligation. It's not that God's saying, "You got to worship me first. You got to say these things. You got to stroke me. Come on. Tell me how good I am. Oh, I'm okay. Now, what do you want?" God is not an egomaniac. You're worshiping him because God knows you need to remember who God is. God knows you need to focus on his character. God doesn't need your worship. God doesn't need your worship. If God needed your worship, that would mean that you have got a God that is incomplete. That he needs something from you in order for him to be complete. We kind of like that, aren't we? One of the things they used to teach us when we were taking education classes, and they take educational psychology, and some educational psychology isn't worth a hoot and a holler. But one of the things that they'd say, and I think Peg would testify to this, is you can kind of tell what a kid's home life is like by the way they're in a class. You can kind of see kids that are bullies sometimes, that you kind of wonder if home isn't a little bit rough. And you kind of have kids sometimes that you're wondering if mom and dad ever praise them, ever compliment them for anything that they ever do, or if all mom and dad do is ride them, that nothing's good enough. Harder, harder, harder. You need to. You know what that's like with your kids. Your kids need you to ride them because they're not going to do it on their own. But they also need compliments when they do it, right? You're not just there to crack the whip. You're also there to tell them, hey, things are going okay. So you and I need that. We need affirmation as human beings. God doesn't. God's not like us. He is perfect without it. Father, we're thankful for the evening that you are indeed the perfect and complete God. You didn't create any of these spirit beings. You didn't create us because you needed fellowship, because you desired fellowship, because there was anything you could derive from us that you did not already have. For you are the full, complete, holy God. And yet you have actually chosen to create us and to allow us to be part of the things that you're accomplishing. We're thankful for that. And you use angels for some of the things that you're accomplishing. And we even get to know some of that. And so, Lord, help us to be people that learn to focus on you. Learn to focus maybe on, well, not just a little less, but maybe a lot less just on us and the things going around us, around things going on around us. Learning to focus more and more on who you are in the midst of these things. And learn to really what it means to worship around other people and the needs that they have, rather than just focusing on the need itself. Thankful for the evening, thankful for who you are, for your power and for your goodness, and again, as we're always reminded, of your constant, undying faithfulness, because you are a God of truth. Amen.